Social Physics. Social Physics is the title. Let me just step in and see how we do. Room 4.
Schedule. I think what I like to do is provide an organizing framework to, because there's a lot of ideas here, and there's a lots of different experience, and in some way we can create a sort of common vocabulary with recalls, factual predicates, whatever that, and advance certain points of view, because there's certain values, there's certain points of view that different parties here have been working on how to approach these problems, and because we really want to move it towards some kind of pilot project or some concrete action. And instead of having just sort of the wise folks intros and intros, because people had a chance to introduce themselves, we could move more into what we call the proposal phase, in which people, there are different parties here working very hard on different approaches that we think have a lot of merit. People, they've taken their own dollar, they've flown out here, as Paul was saying, big-hearted engineers who have been working on this open source software for quite some time. And we think there's a window of opportunity that to really sort of pull this together and demonstrate, much what Charlie was saying, what is possible. I'd like to start with just a quotation from Adam Smith. I mean, and sort of reclaim what has been a conversation that Adam Smith didn't believe that self-interest was the only motivator of human action. In fact, there's a whole sense of recognizing that people had an innate sense of the other person, and being the sense of reciprocity was a very strong motivator. And if you really look at a lot of Adam Smith's writing, some of the best stuff he did was on moral sentiments and understanding markets, and that price wasn't the only determinant, self-interest wasn't there. It was a much more nuanced conversation that has sort of been lost into the current debate. The same thing with Thomas Jefferson. This quotation came out, I lifted it from an article by a man named Paul Zak, who's a neuroeconomist, and writing about the nature of trust and how they actually can measure the oxytocin levels of people in trust, and how trust is inherent in how people do social exchange. In fact, their whole reward system is based around trust, and the traditional notion of markets is advanced in sort of classic economics and national equilibrium theory. It does not predict actual behavior. But the subtext I like to put here is that technology architectures become social and economic architectures, that in making technology, you really are shaping public policy. I mean, a long time ago, I was at another fellowship at Harvard, Tony Andrews' program, and I was involved in information resources policy. And it actually involved information policy at that time. And one of the things that became very clear to me is that policymakers very often are sort of after the fact of the technology, that if the technologists embed certain values, certain principles that become evolved or merged into certain forms of policy. And I think the opportunity here is to collect people with that awareness to say, yes, there's a public policy objective and there's a commercial objective. How do we pull these things together and demonstrate what is possible? So the framework, I say, what are some of the new ideas that are in the air in the zeitgeist? And one of them is how do you think about markets? And I just briefly like to talk about, because that's a key concept. And you're thinking, you hear things about community commerce, you hear about what eBay is doing, you talk about social networks, you have LinkedIn, there is an intuition that our classic notion of markets has to be rethought, and I'd like to address that. Then there's another big issue, and that is the idea of identity and context. Now, maybe there may be some people who think this issue has been dealt with, there's a lot of people who thought about it, but I think we have a point of view that architecturally, that how this is handled becomes very critical, not just from a commercial, technical point of view, but from a public policy point of view, because if you get it wrong, not only you don't enable the self-organizational capabilities that are possible, and that's what's really important. And so a lot of the discussion to date has been around enterprise notions of identity and privacy, but we're thinking of things at the edge. And if you get an edge architecture, you get a lot of benefits. And so I'll stick my neck out and say this is a sort of a key concept that unites a lot of our thinking here. And then the idea is what we call edge organization. I mean, I've been working with the last 4 years with the Department of Defense, more about that later, but they have a notion of edge organization, how to flatten command and control and push it, decision rights at the edge. And actually doing a lot of advanced thinking. And this concept of edge principles or end-to-end architectures is quite important. And as part of that is how do you build trust? And what is the role of reputation in building trust? And again, there's been a lot of basic research done on reputation systems, neuroeconomics. People's reputation is more important to them than getting a special deal on price. And that we're sort of wired that way, and it's what they call an evolutionary stable strategy. Why is that? Because in a sense, reputation precedes you. It's something of your social existence that you cannot sort of compromise in the short term. Another interesting part is how do you aggregate networks? I mean, how do you create networks and networks and create the basis where people can go from one, discover what is in another network and work together? And then the last thing I've talked about a little bit is network influence. I mean, Larry, there's a whole idea of how do you create networks or how do you create advocacy networks to influence certain behaviors and opinions. And again, I think we're moving from just descriptive understandings to actually understanding the mechanics of how that works. I mean, the science and technology is moving into another level. So what I would suggest as a framework for action is that there's a whole notion of an open source for social technologies that we can have. As you'll discover when people talk, there's a lot of technologies being developed that if we can fit it together and make it available as an open source, we can start to implement these platforms. We've done something working with the Eclipse Trust Framework, which is the Eclipse Foundation that IBM spun out. That becomes a framework, it's open source. They're reputation scoring systems, and you may have some companies, for example, like eBay and LinkedIn, who feel you have a closed reputation system. What happens if you open it up? Bill might be interested in that. And then the whole idea of context management. I'm of the view that context is extremely important, and how you can define a context, who can see what about whom, under what kind of conditions, is key to building trust, commercial relationships that persist. There are all these important architectural principles, and that ties in identity management and kind of how partnerships are formed across different networks. Finally, the action plan. I mean, we'd like to have that say, okay, here's some really interesting tracks. We may not resolve it here. There's people will be meeting afterwards, but really identify coherent tracks where things can be done. Please interrupt. So you'll be hearing more about identity and context, but the point of view that's taken here is you have multiple identities. You're just not one person. Identity resides in a particular context. And how you're seen, how you're disclosed, how you're rated is really contextual. And people have evolved highly sophisticated ways in which to interact and disclose themselves. The argument among some of evolutionary biologists is that one of the reasons we have the brain that we do, such as it is that we learn how to manage complex social relationships. And that really accounts for the better part of the evolution of the human brain. So there are very, very concrete, specific kinds of social emotions that we evolve in order to regulate our social interactions. It's a very, very sophisticated thing. It's just not a question of 6 degrees of separation and we're friends. It's really very highly nuanced kind of links and relationships. So in a sense, so how do you deal with this? I mean, how do you have these multiple identities, and how do I appear to people, and how, based upon how I appear, what do I disclose to them, and what do they disclose to me, and how do I protect it? If this fails, if you can't do that well, then you're not going to build the trust. Then you're going to balkanize the whole relationship. And there are many people who have thought about this, and so I hope we can have a good discussion. The other thing I like to talk about is the concept of markets. I mean, We've been taught, okay, that you have a you have the bell-shaped curve. You have the markets are basically. I mean, you could look at even Jeffrey Moore's work in terms of crossing the chasm and early and late adopters. A lot of people say, okay, well, the small tails are the early adopters, and the other tails the late adopters. In the middle, we get people, and this is some kind of explanation. But maybe markets are not a normal distribution, because really, when you think about it, the concept of normal distribution is saying, yeah, I don't have a lot of evidence, so I assume that things are equally probable. It's not really an explanation. It's not even a good description. So you see some work talk about, this is Mary Meeker's stuff at Morgan Stanley. She's an analyst there who has reappeared. She got in a little bit of trouble, but she's back again. And talking about eBay and long-tailed markets, and there was an article in Wired magazine about that. And basically, they're saying, well, gee, one of the count for eBay, they're servicing different sets of the market than they've previously done. You're going to have a bell curve. You may move it a little bit, and you start to get something that is more like power law, a long-tailed market. And the challenge then is how do you serve that long-tailed market? I mean, what are the economics? Is it such that it's only efficient to get the center, or has the technology got to the point where you can start to service the tails of a market, that the efficiencies are there to service the tails? And this really complex, ugly diagram is an attempt to say, how do you chase the long tail market? And the argument being is that, yes, there is sort of a price component where people are very much concerned about sort of getting the best price, and that represents a certain segment. But there's a whole other segment where people are expressing social preferences and they're making distinctions, express themselves in terms of their purchasing behavior. This ties very much into the thinking behind the tariff, but a lot of other parties as well, in which you distinguish yourself by social preferences. And if you're able to, in a sense, organize communities, organize markets, organize relationships around that, and cost of servicing that is sufficiently reduced, you have a new kind of economic model that come out of that. And that is the market as a network. And part of this thinking, most people are probably familiar with David Reed's work, the Reed's Law. Everyone has a law, Metcalfe's Law, Reed's Law. But it's what's interesting about David Reed's Law is he talks about group forming networks. And when I first read this, I was, oh, just another law. And then I recognized it was in 1998 when he predicted that eBay was going to be a great success on sale and the others were not. And why was that? And he would say it's what we call the sneaky exponential. That you have the ability to form networks. He calls it the best facilitator. Basically, you have 2-to-the-n networks. You can create networks out of subgroups. Now, it wasn't just any network. There's a limitation on how many networks you could create, because not all of them are viable. And the point there is, what he called, there's a constant that he had on the number of networks to be created. And I would sort of, for want of a metaphor, call this a trust constant. In other words, how do you go from a network into a community? How do you go to something, and that's based upon the kind of relationships. He called it facilitation. But if you drill down, it really on the nature of the context, the values created in the context. So what we've had looking at social networks to date, and I think the reigning paradigm has been, this is some Duncan Watts work, and you have Barbarossi's work, you have a number of sort of looking at networks as links, but not really as relationships. And the principles, though, the point of view that we've taken is that what really becomes important is the nature of the typing of the links. Who can see what about whom? What are the risk, or the rules of reciprocity? Who can see one, how people rate one another? What are the consequences? Whole issues of trust, transparency, and accountability are mechanisms of control. We talk about shifting decision rights to the edge. How does this thing control itself? Well, it really controls itself through different, what we call social protocols, that affect access and reputation and rating and how things are tagged. So it's a different kind of model than a monolithic model. It is what waste. Nature's work, a lot of things work that way. But it is a break with tradition. No one could read this, but it's a work that I did with DOD in looking at how to create robust networks. And what becomes apparent is that who do you trust, particularly if you look at the Department of Defense, where it's a life and death decision that you're making, and you don't know, you may be a stranger you have to deal with. And how are you going to trust that stranger? You're going to share information, they tell you something, and you're going to put your life at risk. And what you find is that there's a differentiation of roles. There's some people who are like visionaries. There are people who are truth tellers. There's a combination of interactions that create a robustness of a network to create high degrees of trust. So it's not just as, these things become important if you're going to build a robust, trusted network. The other thing that interests me is, and I think it's of interest to a lot of people here, because there's a whole social advocacy perspective, and if you create networks and you're trying to influence public policy, or you're trying to mobilize an interest, or you're trying to affect promotion, what is it that, how can we drill down and look at what is real influence? And my feeling in looking at this is, again, I think we're getting some real insight in this. And I just throw this idea out. The degree of influence is a function of sort of your reach and what I call reputational reciprocity, accountability. And reputational reciprocity is the sense that if someone has a very strong reputation in a network, then they have the consequent reciprocity. People feel they have to reciprocate. There are all these little principles that exist that drive human behavior, and they're wired to our social emotions, our sense of shame, our sense of pride. I mean, they really are sort of looking at the physiology, working up the MRIs of the brain to see this work. So we're getting an insight into how people regulate their behavior vis-a-vis. This isn't just throwing it against the wall, it's just a principle. So reputation becomes extremely important. And you will see, you know, the success of eBay, the reputation systems there, Slashdot. How do you do reputation system? I think we're just at the beginning of understanding what that is. Just at the beginning. And if you're going to try to create a highly effective network, what's the differentiator, whether it be for a social purpose or a commercial purpose, is understanding the context that represents that community that you're working with, that they can articulate and expand who they are through feedback, through tagging, through reputation, how they frame things, how they think about things. Again, another way of achieving influence is how tagging, everyone's talking about tagging and meta tags, and there are things called hooksonomies that are being developed, that tagging is a way, you know, you label someone, they become that, you can frame it, you can imagine the importance of how things are framed in a network to be influential. And that's another point of influence. Recruiting new members, acting as a broker between different networks, these are all the things that are enabled by this. So what I'd like to talk to you about, the commons for social technologies, and put this out, really trying to address Paul's point, is how do you institutionalize this? And what would be the advisory board? Could people step up? Is this something that really is time has come, or maybe it's we're early? But to help advance it, there's a lot of software now that's being developed that needs further development, needs to be put together, and then focused, maybe the target pilots. Projects. Also, there's an issue of patents. I mean, there are a number of, we've already had conversations with people who say, well, are they willing to put their patents into a commons so that you don't create these sets of issues? Open source licensing, creating certain working groups. So I just put that on the table for discussion. And so here are some sort of strawman pilots that we're thinking about. The social issue advocacy networks influencing an outcome. Again, I will speak on Reed's behalf. This is something that he put out there as something of high interest to him. But that's true of other parties here as well. How do you aggregate networks and networks in a principled way so you can search across different networks and discover people and have them work together you otherwise couldn't? Because there are a lot of sort of proprietary systems that are being created. But they're closed worlds. Part of their business model is for them not to, is to contain the reputation system, not to be open. It's our view that doesn't the social value of that, even I think the commercial value is limited. Another interest, lo and behold, is an open media, the whole new kind of media models that come at us. And Chris has articulated that, and Jake as well. And then community commerce, and Greg is, represents that group. So,
John?
Yeah.
Could I, a stupid question here, but what I hear, and often when you speak of this, I hear you wanting to basically invent for social and cultural purposes a kind of an eBay of for the rest of us, or a non-commercial eBay, an eBay for social and political and cultural purpose.
Open source. That is part of it. That's right. It's part of it.
But if you had a magic wand and could create an institution, are you talking? I mean, what would it be? Would it be a new political party? Would it be a new television network? Would it be a university?
I think what it's. It's prior to that. I mean, I think we're at a point where we have to, there's technology architectural issues that need to be, people need to be understood. And we need to get technologies out there that are open source that people can build upon and develop.
We have those, presumably.
We're just in early phase of that. So I think that's one component of it. And then I think then you want to have an exemplar of that. In terms of a sort of a problem or a pilot track, whether it be in media or some other area, would you sort of test those concepts?
I think we're talking about physics that applies universally in theory, and then lots of constructed platforms that use those rules that are
those
all
principles.
Very different. Yeah.
I think that from an adoption point of view, I mean, I think to get people to focus on it, you really they have to see an instantiation of it. They have to see, a real application. One thing I wanted to propose is like, I think one of the first things that's important is the whole issue of identity, how that's managed. Because I think if that's done wrong, then you don't have the question of authentication, and you don't have the flexibility to create trusted systems that you need to do. So I put that on the table. And then I think there's another step, and Paul talked to this, is so that how do you have interoperable social networks? How can you sort of aggregate across different networks, search across different meta-search? Because people like to have loose affiliations, and they discover a lot of things, and then they may have tight, you know, loose affiliations, and then certain social, tightened social ties, so they want to do something of consequence. We're doing the social physics doing a lot of work in trust frameworks, open source trust frameworks. What does that constitute? So if you can really have a verifiable trust framework, I think that opens up a lot of opportunities rather than having it closed proprietary systems.
So, does this sort of make sense to you?
Yeah, so you don't get that. Yeah. And then the idea is how do you start to pursue certain long tail markets? And then the whole idea of meta tagging and data, and being able to aggregate data and target it into a community. Have distribution systems really designed to reflect the point of view of the community itself being able to shape the nature of the content that comes into it. I mean, I think that is a huge different problem. But there are architectural principles required to do that. You have to be able, I think, be able to handle the context management problem. And then the further out notion is what kind of digital institutions do we have and enable them? I mean, how do you write contracts, enforce contracts? What are the rules of assembly? Can you have a micro firms? There are a number of people thinking about that. They can own assets. And so you say, well, gee, what is a whole legal regime and a governance regime that's adapted to what this the new technology enables?
Lawyers are always looking.
Yeah, well, it's the law school, right? So at some point, I think we still have classic business models where you sort of monetize the artifact itself. But I think as we move along, you're really going to lock up markets, you're going to monetize the relationships. And it's going to be a subscription model. I'm just throwing that out in the second impression, but I think it's a different perspective.
So I didn't hear an answer to Chris's question.
My answer to Chris is that we're at a point where we want to create the technology platforms to enable, whether it be a new media, a new kind of media model, or a new kind of commerce model, or a new kind of social advocacy. I think that in order to have that new entity, there's certain things that have to be in place. You have to deal with the identity, and we're not there yet. I'd argue that we're not there yet. A lot of stuff is out there, needs to be, and there are people here that a good discussion. You need to pull it together in order to show what's possible to do that, because it's not there in my mind.
Can I just put
a little tiny bit?
It seems to me, I don't know how many people in this group are in a position to improve on eBay's technology push. It seems to me they've got a model right there in terms of efficiency, validation, identity.
All
I mean to say is it's so far ahead of what we have in a political, conversational media realm. My urgent thing with the magic wand is to use the eBay model to construct a social conversation.
Knowing Chris, I think what we're saying is there's a principle. There's a principle in the eBay model that are, you know, it's right. Yes, you have reputation-based system, you have community competence. There's some general principles that are correct, but those only go so far, and I think there are more, and it's how you open it up.
My answer would only be, John, that media, political, cultural, conversational world is now way, way, way behind the tools that are being applied in commerce, and it's for politics and media to catch up with what eBay is doing every day and lots of others.
What eBay is doing is very, very specific to eBay. It's not a platform. It relies on transactions and money, and it's not reusable very easily in other contexts. It looks as if it is, but it isn't. It's also very subject to inflation and gaming the system, which eBay won't tell you. I mean, they've got much better press than they deserve, wonderful as they are, but it's not that extensible. It's a great model to look at, but it's very specific.
There's another fundamental problem that is owned by eBay.
Pierre Omidyar is very much out in the market. If you came up with something else, he would happily fund it, other than.
I think what we really want is we want something that really is flexible enough to represent the principles we're outlining here, that is a common good. We want to try and set a standard, and then we can use it for a whole bunch of purposes, and it will make markets much more efficient, firms much more efficient, political processes much more efficient, as long as we are not foolish enough to have a particular company own it and restrict it. A common good is what I think we should be aiming for here.
On the and side of that, the interesting thing would be to be able to take and know that you, John, are that John from eBay, but it's in a different context. But your identity, the trust, your history comes with you. So you don't have to reestablish yourself in that community. And it's kind of, I think, interesting, because I think eBay is probably less averse to that kind of behavior because of the way that they see themselves in the market than some other players would be. But that basic mechanism is not there right now. I can't log on to eBay and then go log on to a political discussion website and share my identity.
So there is now a company that we should look at called Opinity that is trying to create a cross-reputation system engine.
Is it open source? Is it?
No, but you should talk to them.
Okay. Exactly.
If you can give them an alternative business model, they'd be happy.
Yeah, okay.
But it's probably available for cheap enough price.
Okay. The deal could be had, right? Right. That's a business model.
I think that the notion that this starts with identity is the right notion. And a lot of the other things that I see here are not standards per se. They're maybe formats and how those formats are applied. You know, RSS is a format. You can use it for anything, contain anything. It's really how those get applied. So there are formats you can help. Yeah, I think the identity piece is the most fundamental. There is there's been an enormous amount of work there. So I think we should recognize that work and as a group talk about it, because we don't need to get into a discussion about which standard and that standard and so on. But for example, the Liberty Alliance has been reasonably successful defining a very rich suite of standards that deal with trust amongst informal networks of organizations, define ways in which those networks can trust one another, define means to allow an individual to have sort of distributed profile information across all the services they interact with. And for one organization, the eBay example is just given, you log into eBay and then you go somewhere else and to have that context flow. I mean, so it's a very rich set of capabilities there. What hasn't, and in some respects, though, if you look at the standards as they define it, it's a lot of consumer companies and financial services companies right. and carriers and software companies and others that have worked on that. They've over-engineered. There's a lot there. If you unpack it all, there's like 15 different standards that are part of that. But if you go through them, what you'll find is that they actually address a great deal of this. And what's happened, at least from my vantage point, is that they were over-engineered to the point where the very, very basic problem of how do you let two organizations on the internet trust each other and trust the identities that are established in each of those domains and pass basic information about those users between us. That very, very basic use case has not been widely established. We don't do it today. So there's I think, very good effort from big companies and small companies to resolve the standards issues. But I think those are imminent and in front of us, and what it really requires is for very practical, pragmatic right. use cases that these organizations begin to work with these, and they can begin to layer in some of the other dimensions over time.
Well, okay, that's a really important point, and I think that there's a group of people that have thought a lot about the Liberty Alliance and talked in this conversation that I don't know if you want to engage that at this point, because
I totally agree with everything he said.
Okay, Paul?